Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Tim Porter. I'm one of the pastors here. Thank you so much for being here with us this morning. And if you're new to gathering with us, I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes or so teaching from the Bible. And if you have any questions about anything I have to say during this time, or what does it look like to take the next steps in following Jesus, I'll be available right after the service. I'd love for you to come on up and at least introduce yourself and get to know one another, and I'll try to answer any questions you might have. We're starting a new series today, and it's called Anchored. And one of the reasons why we're starting this series now is because we're living in a time that is different than any other time that we've experienced as a culture. Things are more angsty right now. There's more anxiety right now. There's more pressure right now. There's more divisiveness right now than what we've experienced in a really long time. You know, historians are sort of trained to look back into history and to tell each generation that it's living that you know what you're going through right now really isn't all that unique. You're not all that important as a generation. But even historians are saying that our cultural moment is different than what's been happening in world history for a very long time. We're going through right now. We feel it. We're going through a time of change that has not been experienced in our culture since the Industrial Revolution. And a large part of it is because of technology. So, for example, you know, maybe you're a parent and you're here this morning and you want to help your child with homework, but they're coming home with technological tools that you have no idea how to use. You have no idea how you're going to help them with that homework. You know, that's one way. Or maybe you've met your neighbors. You know, you've done what we've asked you to do. You love your neighbors. You've met your neighbors, and they seem like really nice people. You'd like to get to know them a little bit more, but you know you are so busy right now. There is no way you have any time in the next 6 months to invite them over and at least have a cup of coffee and hang out and get to know them a little bit more. Things are different. We're busy. We're very busy. You know, I don't know if this has happened to you. It's happened to me. I put down an appointment, and I want to meet with somebody, and I put it on. I put an appointment on my phone, you know, on my calendar, and I go, you know what? In 3 months, when I have to keep this, I know I'm going to have to change it. I'm just going to be too. I'm just too busy. Some of you, we've got Lent starting up, and some of you are wanting maybe to take a little technological fast. You're going to fast from mobile devices. You know that you're a little concerned with how mobile technology has invaded your family. And so you want to take some time off. You want to get off of Facebook and other social media. But you realize, boy, if I do that, am I going to stay connected to my friends? Because our lives are so connected through our mobile devices. Maybe if you're on Facebook, you've done something crazy like this. You've made a political post. And you got hammered. Or you laughed when you saw a friend do that. And you go, oh, I can't wait to see what happens here, right? Why? We're divisive. We've got a lot of passion about some of these things. I don't know if you've noticed, but work is changing as well. Maybe your field is changing so much that you have to work just 50 hours. You have to work at least 50 hours a week to keep up. Anybody here between the ages between 22 and 37? Anybody here between 22 and 37? Now, you're called the millennials, right? Now, a lot of people make fun of millennials. Don't worry. Every other generation was made fun of before you, right? But do you know what people are starting to call your generation as millennials? It's actually concerning. The burnout generation. The burnout generation. Why? Because our view of work is dramatically changing. We're trying to get meaning and purpose. You, as a generation, millennials, are trying to get meaning and purpose out of your work. Just this last week, I was reading an article in The Atlantic. The author writes, in a recent Pew Research report on the epidemic of youth anxiety. Did you hear that? The epidemic of youth anxiety. 95% of teens said having a job or career that they enjoy would be extremely or very important. Not a bad thing. But this desire ranked higher than any other priority that they have, including helping other people who are in need, 81%. Or being married, 47%. Hear what that means. Finding meaning at work beats family and kindness. and finding meaning in life. Friends, we are going through changes, and there are waves that are swelling, and they are rushing over the sides of the boat, and we need to find something to be anchored in during this time. And that's why we're doing this series called Anchored, because God actually has the resources to anchor our hearts in his grace as we go through these massive changes that our culture has not seen before, at least in a really long time. And so in this series, we're going to talk about technology, we're going to talk about work, we're going to talk about rest, talk about stress, we're going to talk about politics, we're going to talk about these things and teach on them. But to kick off this series, I want to begin with something that sort of goes unspoken, but's happening to us all the time, and I want to try to give us eyes to see what's going on, because as we understand this part of the shift that's going on in our culture, the changes or some of the anxiety and some of the angst that we feel, if we understand this, it'll help us through these changes, and that is identity. Your self-understanding of who you are, your self-identity. Now, identity, our identity, your identity, is your personal answer to three very important questions about you and your life. To what do I aspire? You have an answer to that question. In other words, what are you living for? To what do I aspire? What am I worth? In other words, how am I doing with aspiring performing to get what I aspire to? Your worth is dependent on how you answer that question. And the last question about identity is who gets to say? Who gets to tell you what you're worth? Who gets to answer that question? You are seeking to answer those questions with your life. I'm seeking to answer those questions with my life. And guess what? Our culture doesn't ask us permission, and our culture doesn't even tell us that it's doing this, but our culture is telling us how to answer those questions all the time. And if you're not aware of it, if your eyes aren't open to it, you're just going to go right along. Go right along with how the culture is telling you to answer those questions, and you'll experience more angst, more anxiety, more divisiveness than you ever imagined. Because our culture's answer to these questions aren't what our heart really needs to hear. Because our culture actually is trying to get us to build our identities on an achieved identity. Now, usually at this point in time in my sermon, if you are around here much, I'm going to jump into the biblical text and we're going to read through it, but we're not going to do that just yet. I'm only talking about one verse today, and I'm going to get to that in just a few moments, but I want to try to deconstruct just a little bit here, this whole notion of an achieved identity, because we need eyes to see it, because it's happening all the time. It's happening all the time. There's an achieved identity messaging that you and I hear from almost every source in our culture, except from the gospel, except from the Bible. Here's what it can look like. Here's some of the messaging phrases. Be who you want to be. Be who you want to be. Follow your dreams. Find yourself. Don't let anyone get in the way of your dreams. That's messaging for an achieved identity, an inside-out achieved identity. Look inside, see who you are, and don't let anybody tell you what to do, and just follow your dreams and accomplish much, and then you'll show that you're worth much. A couple weeks ago, in light of all the snowstorms that we've had, I saw a meme on Twitter with a picture of Elsa from Frozen that said, whoever made Elsa angry needs to quickly go and apologize. So in keeping with Frozen and in keeping with some more freezing temperatures today, let me just give you a little quote from the movie Frozen. Some of you are going to be able to finish this line. It's time to see what I can do, to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me, I'm free. Some of you need to have more girls. Or maybe they're down in life shaping. But anyway, let it go, let it snow, all that is wrapped up in that. But what's the message? What's the message of Frozen? An achieved identity. That's the core of it. You're watching that movie, it's telling you this is how you get your identity. Look inside. Don't let anybody else tell you what your dreams are. Don't do that at all. It's all inside and then accomplish. And the rest of the world has to adapt. This last week, I finally got around to watching The Greatest Showman. Have you seen that? I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it's just beautiful. It just shows how behind the times I am. But my wife told me, you got to watch this movie. It's so good. I'm like, yeah. I'll go watch some blow 'em up movie. You know, that's got to be better. But this was awesome. It was awesome, you know. But what's the greatest showman all about? Barnum. He's got to prove himself. It's all about achieved identity. There's a turning point in the whole movie, the musical, where the circus people, the outsiders, the freaks, sing this song. When the sharpest words want to cut me down, I'm going to send a flood, going to drown them out. I'm brave. I'm bruised. I'm who I'm meant to be. This is me. Look out, because here I come. I'm marching on to the beat I drum. I'm not scared to be seen. I make no apologies. This is me. That's an inside-out achieved identity. That's the whole point of the movie. Where do you get it from? Look inside, be who you are, and then don't let anybody get in your way and accomplish much, and you'll be worth something. And there's another part of it that's like, you need to accomplish much to be able to tell yourself that you're actually worth something. Look inside, identify your desires, your passions, your dreams, go after your goals, and the rest of the world will have to adapt to you. Don't let anyone tell you what you cannot do. This is called freedom. But quite frankly, this is far more enslaving than freeing. From the same Atlantic article, millennials are meaning junkies at work. So this is you, 22 to 37-year-olds. Millennials are meaning junkies at work. Like all employees, one Gallup survey concluded, millennials care about their income, but for this generation, a job is far more than a paycheck. It's about a purpose for life. It's about a purpose for your identity. Who am I? Look what I do at my work. I do meaningful work, and I do it meaningfully. I'm somebody. This author goes on, I don't know if they're a Christian or not, but they said the problem with this gospel, so it's a different gospel. Problem with this gospel of finding meaning and purpose in your work is your dream job is out there, so never stop hustling. Quite frankly, it's a blueprint for spiritual and physical exhaustion. Long hours do not make anyone more productive or creative. They just make people stressed out, tired, and bitter. It's not freedom. It's more enslaving. Let me just pick a little bit more at it. One of the reasons why it's enslaving is that, quite frankly, it's confusing. I mean, think about it. We're told over and over by our culture, look inside, figure out who you are, find yourself, pay attention to your desires, and your desires tell you who you really are, and the rest of the world has to adapt to you. Now, just think about that for a little bit. Which desires are your true self? I've known people who for their whole life, they wanted to be married. They thought that I'm going to have meaning in life when I get married. I want to be married. 10 years after being married, they're like, oh, I want to be single. I'm not kidding. Which desires are your true desires? To be married? Is that your true self? To be single? Is that your true self? Those of you who are 20, when you look back into your teens, are there things there that you believed and thought were silly? It's like, oh man, that was so foolish. You look back on that. Here, anybody like that? Those of you in your 30s, you look back in your 20s and you're like, oh man, I believed and thought and did some really dumb things. I was an idiot. Anybody like that? 30s, looking back in your 20s? How about 40s, looking back in your 30s? That's where I am. I'm like, oh yeah, 30s, 40s. Oh man, I had no idea what was going on in life. I do now. 60s, you're looking way back. 70s, oh man, you're looking way, way, way back. You know, what does that tell you? Whatever you are right now, whatever you believe right now, your future self's going to look back on something and go, you were an idiot. What does that mean? Everybody in the room's a fool. Think about it. What desires are you going to pay attention to? Which desires tell you are you real self? This is one of the things that's going on with sexual identity. It's so confusing. What desires actually tell you who you really are? It's maddening. But not only that, it's actually fragile and it's crushing. If you look inside, try to figure out who you are, and you're making your own life and you're making your own self, you want to become somebody, and you have to achieve to do that, it's crushing, it's fragile. Here's one successful person, I can tell you who they are right now until the end, but she says this way about herself, I am my own experiment. I am my own work of art. And she also says this, All of my will has always been to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. I'm always struggling with that fear. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being. And then I get to another stage and I think I'm mediocre and I'm uninteresting. And I have to find a way to get myself out of that again and again and again. My drive in life is from this horrible fear of being mediocre. And that's always pushing me. Because even though I've become somebody, I still have to prove that somebody. My struggle has never ended, and it probably never will. Do you know who said that? Madonna. Everybody looks at Madonna and goes, oh man, she's a success. She's driven by this crushing, fragile fear to prove that she's somebody by what she accomplishes, even though she's her own work of art. It's fragile. Now I'm in this too. I'm with this. Every Monday at about noon, we get together as a worship planning team. There's about seven of us, and we go through the worship service, and we think, okay, we ask questions. Was Jesus front and center? Did we do everything we possibly could on Sunday morning to help everyone meet, know, and follow Jesus? We pick apart the sermon. We pick apart the songs. We pick apart everything that we do. Everything gets critiqued and celebrated. A few months ago, someone made the worst statement in the world in one of our meetings. They said to me, that was almost the perfect sermon. And I thought, almost? Were you listening to the same sermon that I was listening to? Because that was the perfect sermon, right? Almost the perfect sermon. There's a part of me in my heart that's going, yes, all the work I've been doing is paying off. Okay, wonderful. Yeah, thank you very much. There's another part of me, don't tell me that. I've got to preach next week. You know what kind of burden it is to live under? I just almost preached the perfect sermon. That's a huge pressure. Well, why? What's going on in me? It is so easy for me because I live in this culture and my heart wants to do it too. I want to make pastoring, I want to make preaching my identity. That's what I want to do. That's what I'm tempted to do. And if I'm not paying attention to it, I'm going to do that. One of my goals for 2019 is to continually learn how to build my identity in Christ. And that's one of the reasons why we're looking at this, is because what we need, what we're made for, is not an achieved identity, but a received identity. A received identity. And this is where we want to look at the Bible, because this is where the Apostle Paul wrote a letter to the Galatians, and he gave them a verse. He said this sentence, this phrase about an identity, and moving from an achieved identity to a received identity. And this is the verse. He wrote in Galatians 2:20, it'll be on the screen above, I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Now the context of this verse is that Paul was writing to the church in Galatia, and they started out in following Christ, and they had a received identity. They belonged to Jesus. And then some other people came in after the gospel had been proclaimed there and believed in Jesus. They met Jesus and started to follow him. Some other people came in behind and said, no, you need more than Jesus. You need to achieve something. You need to not just have Jesus, which is great, but you need to take on the Old Testament laws, and you need to take on a Jewish identity. Then you'll show that you really belong to God. And one of the things that Paul's writing to is to say, look, whenever you add anything to Jesus, you actually subtract from Jesus. It's Jesus, a received identity. And what Paul does in this passage is that he shows us how to move from an achieved identity and how to live out a received identity. So, first, how do we do that? He says in the first line, I have been crucified with Christ. I have been crucified with Christ. And because of his new relationship with Jesus, because of Paul's new relationship with Jesus, he sees that when Jesus died, he died as a representative, and Jesus' death changed Paul. Jesus' death changed Paul. Something about Paul died, and it was him, his old identity, the way that he used to try to make himself somebody before others and before God. That died when Jesus died. That died, and Paul I'm trying to think like this week, like, okay, how do I represent this? Or how should I process this in my own head to help me move from an achieved identity to a received identity? And I was just reminded this week, or last week, we celebrated our oldest son's 18th birthday, and we moved here from White Bear Lake. We moved here, my wife and I moved from White Bear Lake in 2001. And we moved and we built a home out on the east of Willow River State Park. And when we moved out here, Levi was 7 months old. And we were his representatives. We took actions. We did things that completely affected him. He was 7 months old. He went from being a Minnesota resident to now being a Wisconsin resident. And what Paul is saying is that when Jesus died, something happened, just like what happened to Levi. He went from being a Minnesota resident to a Wisconsin resident. Woohoo! Paul's saying, something happened to me when I died. And Paul's saying, something happened to you when Jesus died. Your whole way of trying to get an identity for yourself, an achieved identity for yourself, died when Jesus died. It's dead. I mean, imagine how aghast I would be if Levi came home with a Vikings jersey. No, son, you don't want to identify with that team. They can't even win a Super Bowl. No. There's 50% of the audience right now that's laughing. No, you're a Wisconsin resident. Yes, you're now a Packer fan. No, he's not really. But the idea is you've changed. Your achievement identity faculties, functions of your heart are dead. So one of the things that you and I have to do is we have to speak to that it's dead. So I have to remind myself daily, I am dead to trying to achieve an identity based on being a good pastor and preacher. It's crucified. I'm dead to being a successful businesswoman and building my identity on that. It's crucified. I'm dead to being academically accomplished in some way, building my identity on that. It's crucified. It's dead. Successful musician, attempting to build my identity on that achievement. It's dead. It's crucified. I can't bring it back to life. Homeschool mom, trying to build your identity on the success of your children. It's dead. It's not living anymore. It's crucified with Christ. To get a little graphic, it'd be like sort of driving on UU out here and seeing the roadkill of a deer on the side of the road. Opening it up, putting it on, and go, hey, I'm a deer. It doesn't work. It's dead. We say to our hearts and we remind ourselves, you say this in DNA groups, you say this in your missional communities, you're dead to that. It's dead. But Paul says, not only is there something dead, there's something alive. We put something on. So we put something off and then we put something back on. Paul says, it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. What does that mean? It means this relationship. It means that following Jesus is not just about following certain religious duties or coming and doing certain spiritual disciplines and coming to church and praying and that kind of stuff. It's actually about having a relationship with a risen Savior, a risen man, who changes your whole life. You have a relationship with him, a union with him, so that all that's true about Jesus becomes true of you. When I first married my wife, actually when I was dating my wife and married my wife, she owned a 1991 cherry red Toyota Celica. It was the nicest car we ever owned. Wonderful sound system in it, spoiler, sunroof. I mean, it's fast. Boys, don't hear that. It was fast. Enjoyed it completely. The day I said I do, or better, the day she said I do, that became all mine. Ours, right? Why? Because everything that belonged to my wife when I married her and became in relationship with her and union with her, everything that belonged to her became mine. Everything that belonged to me became hers. Getting into relationship with Jesus is like going into relationship as a man. You've got all kinds of school debt. You've got hundreds of thousands of dollars of school debt, and you marry somebody who has more wealth than the federal government knows how to spend. And it all belongs to you now. That's what it's like to be in relationship with Jesus. Everything that's true of him becomes true of you. All of his beauty, all of his perfection, all of his goodness, all of his purity, all of his worth, all of his glory, all of the life that Jesus has now belongs to you. All of the love that the Father has for the Son, all of the praise that Jesus has now, that belongs to you. All the approval that Jesus has of his Father, that now belongs to you in relationship with Jesus. There's a union that goes on. I don't live anymore. My old identity of trying to make myself somebody through my accomplishments and my achievements, that's dead. I have something far grander now to base my whole identity in. I am deeply, profoundly loved, and everything that belongs to Jesus, all his glory, all his goodness, all his purity, it now becomes mine. We're in union together. Paul goes on to say how that happened. He says, Jesus, I live by faith in the one who loved me and gave himself for me. How is it that we can have all that Jesus has earned? It's because he's my substitute. He's a substitute for me. He filled in for me. He's done what I could not do. He's done what you cannot do. About a week and a half ago, I was getting my haircut, my beard trimmed. Yes, I do trim it every now and again. There's a girl that I go to, a lady that I go to. Her name's Jess, and this is a Thursday right after the big snowstorm in the middle of the week, like 2 weeks ago, right? Wednesday. I know they're all back to back, but you know, try to remember, right? It was a Wednesday where there was that massive snowstorm, and I was getting my hair cut by her on Thursday, and we were just talking. She's cut my boy's hair, and so we were just talking about life and stuff, and she was telling me about how she couldn't get to work on Wednesday. She lives up in St. Croix Falls, and the roads are all completely closed, and she couldn't get down, even though she's got a four-wheel truck, and she called somebody to fill in for her, to substitute for her. And she's just talking to me about that. Substitute. Came in and did the work for her so she could keep her job. That's sort of what Jesus does for us. She was unable to come into work. Somebody else did the work for her. You and I are unable to get approval by God, from God, and to make ourselves somebody really to the one who really counts. We're not able to do that on our own. But Jesus has done it for us. He's substituted himself for us. But it's a little bit different. Jess didn't get paid because this other person worked. But we do. Because Jesus did all the work, you and I get all the payment that he receives, all the glory that he reserves. He's our substitute. He obeyed every command for us. He always loved everyone for us. He lived for us. He had perfect faith for us. He lived the life that you and I are made to live. He did it for you. He accomplished much, and it all belongs to you if you receive that identity. He died in your place. He didn't die from old age. He didn't die from disease. He died an excruciating death, knowing that exactly what he was doing. He was dying in your place. And that's why he did it. He died because we want to try to build our identity on something other than God. And whenever we do that, it's an idol. And it will enslave you. He did it for us so that we can rest in his work. You and I, if we come to Jesus, we get a received identity. Our biggest questions are answered. What do I aspire to? I aspire to faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. What am I worth? Jesus shows me he was willing to die for me. Who gets to say? Jesus gets to say. And he's the only one that matters. And this is what he said. I love you. You belong to me. I died for you. I live for you. Why did he do it? Because he loved us. But before we think about that, I just want to ask you. I mean, ask yourself, ask your own heart. If the greatest, most beautiful, most praiseworthy being in all of existence finds you praiseworthy, finds you worthy of honor, all because of what his son did. Why do you care what other people think? Why are you working so hard to make yourself a somebody when Jesus has already made you somebody? Why did Jesus do it? He loved me. That's what Paul says. He loved you. I mentioned earlier that it's sort of a farce that we can just sort of like look into ourselves and just affirm ourselves. We can't affirm ourselves. We need somebody else. We're designed to have somebody else affirm us. somebody else to speak into our lives and tell us of our worth and tell us of what they think of us. And one of the things that Jesus has done is that he said, I love you. The God of the universe says, I love you. And that voice needs to be the most important voice that you build your whole existence on. I love you. The most beautiful, great, glorious, praiseworthy, honorable person in all existence says, I love you. I love you. Now, many people love me, or some people have loved me at my best. Or no, get straight, Tim. Many people love me at my best. Some people have loved me knowing my failures. But only Jesus knows me fully and completely and loves me fully and completely at the same time. He's never surprised by the things that surprise me. I'm like, oh, I really think that? I'm really like that? Oh, no. He died knowing full well what I would be like in my place. What do we do? Paul says this. If we give up, the achieved identity, it's dead. We're dead to it. What Jesus gives us instead is received identity. And what we continue to do is we live in it and we believe this Son, the Son of God, who loved us and gave himself for us. The life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God. We live right now in faith, trusting that what Jesus says, what Jesus did, and what Jesus said is enough before God, more than enough before God, to make us somebody, to make us worthy to stand before God, to gain all of his approval. Paul had to keep believing this because Paul was tempted, just like you and I are tempted, to try to go back to an achieved identity. And so every day you're reminding yourself, this is who Jesus is. Jesus, whatever I'm tempted to aspire to build my life on right now, I am dead to that. It's dead. It doesn't work. It's like putting a carcass of a deer on and trying to pretend I'm a deer. Can't do it. Doesn't work. Instead, what I do is I build my whole life on my aspiration is to live for Jesus because he loved me. He died for me. He substituted himself for me. We keep living on this. We keep believing this daily because we're always tempted to go back to an achieved identity. So the questions are for you today, what are you trying to live for? To what do you aspire? Paul says, aspire to this. Have faith always in the Son of God who loved you. That's your aspiration. I want to live every day believing that Jesus loved me and he gave himself for me. What am I worth? Jesus gave his life for me. I get everything that belongs to Jesus, it becomes mine. What am I worth? Who gets to say? There's only one voice that at the end day really matters and determines everything about us, and it's God's voice. He speaks, and what he speaks reshapes everything about me. Now we're going to pick up this theme in each sermon in this series for 7 weeks of identity and show how does it rework our work, how does it rework our stress, how does it rework our use of technology, how does it rework these things? So one of the things I want to recommend to you, just to give you some homework, is that if you don't have Galatians 2:20 memorized over the next 7 weeks, just memorize it. Just memorize it. I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Start there, memorizing that. We'll come back each week and talk about what does an identity in Christ look like? How does that reshape our work and other things? But today I want to let you know that we're going to celebrate a meal together. We're going to do communion together. And in this meal, Jesus reminds us that he's our substitute. He substituted ourselves. And so this is an identity, a Christ identity shaping kind of meal. As we take the bread, Jesus says, this is my body given for you. Everything that's true about me is true of you. Everything that you once were, I've paid for, Jesus says. Jesus says, this cup is my blood poured out for you. I died on your behalf. Everything that was true about you that needed to be changed, I took on and I've paid for. And everything true about me now becomes true of you, Jesus says. Now, this is a meal that Jesus gave his followers so that you and I would remember that Jesus was our substitute and build our whole life on him as our substitute and let him tell us our identity. And this is a meal that Jesus gave to his followers to remember him. And so if you're not a follower yet today, I just want to ask you to just watch what we do during this time of as we take the bread and the cup. And we look forward to the day when you meet and follow Jesus. We look forward to that day and we pray for that day. But until then, just watch what we do and maybe ask yourself these questions. What am I living for? Where do I get my worth from? And who gets to say? Is what you're living for to get your worth, is it worth it? Will it free you or will it crush you? And Christian, as you prepare to take this meal, I just want to ask you to, if there's any way that you know that you've been confessing Jesus, but you've been building your identity on something else, ask Jesus for forgiveness. Name it. Remind yourself that you're dead to it. And remind yourself that Jesus died so that you could receive an identity that he earned that nothing can take away. It's secure.